This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Around the country, the minimum wage varies widely, from states tied to the federal minimum, like New Hampshire at $7.25 an hour, to a max of $13 an hour in San Francisco. At the start of this year, the minimum wage went up in 14 states, and five more will decide whether to do so in this fall's elections. These include our neighbor Maine, where ballot question 5 would phase in an increase to $12 by the year 2020. Today in The Exchange, we revisit the minimum wage debate in New Hampshire, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, or if you prefer Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, it's NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour. Jackie Silly is here, Democratic State Representative from Barrington, a former state senator. Representative Silly, good to see you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Also with us, Charlie Arlinghouse, president of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. That's a think tank here in Concord. And Charlie Arlinghouse, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good to see you.
Well, and Representative Silly, for you first, we'll go through the pros and cons throughout the hour. But just the political debate, Representative Silly, how does it sound different now in 2016?
Oh, it's changed dramatically just in the last couple of years. I mean, you may remember that, President Obama had proposed a $10.10 minimum wage federally just a couple of years ago. And now I think we're hearing $15 as the standard.
So in terms of just the actual level, the money amount, that's changed.
Well, the money amount has changed, but I also think that, we have the American people on our side in terms of, increasing the minimum wage. I mean, everybody knows that $7.25 at the federal level is not livable.
What do you think, Charlie Arlinghouse? How has the political debate changed? And then we'll get into the economics of this.
Well, I think dollar amounts have changed and things like that. But I think if you go back and look at the literature around minimum wage debates, it seems to me that not really that much has changed. I was reading a paper from the mid-70s, from when there's a Federal Minimum Wage Study Commission. And the arguments then and the arguments in the mid-2000s and the arguments today are kind of similar. The things that researchers look at are the same. The arguments on the one side for it are kind of the same. The arguments on the side against it are the same. And I think that this is sort of a – this is one of those issues that has been around for a long time.
Sure.
And I'm not saying the debate has been resolved or anything else, but what I'm saying is that the issues are very similar and the arguments are very familiar. And I think Jimmy Carter would recognize most of what we're talking about today.
So has anything really changed, Charlie, in your mind? Beyond those pro-con economic arguments?
Well, not really. I mean, I think that I have the same opinion I did 15 years ago, and I think Senator Silly probably has the same opinion she did 15 years ago.
Representative Silly, what do you think?
I want to just address that. I mean, we now have empirical studies. I mean, the thing of it is that we've had these economic models for a long time, supply and demand, which I think, you rely on pretty heavily, Charlie. And the reality is that we now can look at what actually has gone on the ground. And because it was only in 1998 that the states got the right to set their own minimum wage, the federal minimum wage went into place in 1938, but the states didn't get their right to implement their own personal minimum wage until about 1998. Since that time, we can now see what's actually happened on the ground. So, I mean, last week, Bloomberg came out with an article that showed that all of the rhetoric around Seattle raising their minimum wage to $15 an hour has not turned out to be true. They have a robust economy. Their unemployment rate is dropping below 4%. None of the arguments that have been made against increasing the minimum wage have turned out to be true.
Well, that's one thing that I have noticed that has changed is that states and even cities
have changed the minimum wage and counties.
And I wonder what you think about that, Charlie, sort of this patchwork of minimum wages that we see cropping up.
Well, I think that one of the things that we're going to discover as we talk about this today is that there are one of the characteristics of the minimum wage debate is that people on each side have economic studies that they cite to prove their point. And people on each side of the debate will look at what happened in, let's take Seattle as an example, and look at it very differently. And people on my side of the debate, people who think raising minimum wages is harmful to the people that it wants to help, will cite Seattle as the best example that proves our case. And Representative Silly will cite Seattle as the best example that proves her case. And what happens is we look at the same thing happening on the ground, and we look at different things and we interpret it differently. And, you know, I think the last time I debated this publicly, the other guy and I got up and we each cited economic studies proving our side. And in the end, during one of the questions, I said, look, I'm going to cite economic studies that prove raising minimum wage is harmful. He's going to cite economic studies proving that it's not harmful. And at some point, you're going to have to decide which you believe. But the data is not obviously one way or the other.
So we can't draw anything, Charlie, from these cities like San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, D.C., New York, we can't conclude anything from those wage hikes?
I think you can, but I think Representative Silly is going to disagree with me. I mean, one of the things I'm going to look at is I'm going to say to you that if you look at Seattle, what you'll find is that low-wage jobs have declined. And it presents a great case where you compare Seattle to the area around Seattle. And you look at what's happening with the same kind of jobs in Seattle and the same kind of jobs just outside Seattle, the other side of the minimum wage border. And what you'll see is a tremendous disemployment inside Seattle.
Can you talk about that too, Representative Silly? I've met somebody recently from Portland, Maine, for example, mm-hmm. which I think has increased its city minimum wage, mm-hmm. but the towns outside Portland have not, so it's tricky.
Well, I mean, there's been a recent study by Aaron Doobie out of the University of Massachusetts and looking at data of what happened, as I said, not models. And they did a cross-border study of counties where in one state the minimum wage was, you know, higher than in another state. And what they've discovered is that there is no significant impact on youth employment or on low-wage employment, that those jobs, you know, that those jobs are increasing. Seattle, again, their unemployment is below 4%. Jobs are being grown in Seattle. New restaurants are opening. I mean, you know, all of the metrics support the fact that diligently increasing the minimum wage has actually positive effects on the economy. And I would also add that at the federal level, I think, and Charlie, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, I think the federal minimum wage has been raised 37 times. I think if you include the states, it's something like 64 times. And we do not see the deleterious effects of an increase in minimum wage that Charlie's side of the aisle would argue. And I would also point out that in Washington, which has the highest minimum wage nationally, since 1998, they've been raising their minimum wage, and there has only been one instance, and that's statewide, Charlie. That's not just, you know, outside of Seattle. There's only been one instance of a year following an increase in the minimum wage where the economy shrunk a bit, and there's an argument that there were other factors that came into play.
Charlie, do you want to jump in?
No, I want to, because the Seattle argument is interesting, because Mark Perry from the University of Michigan at Flint, a business professor there, has studied the Seattle situation extensively as well. And one of the things that he shows is Seattle in the middle of an area that is experiencing relatively low unemployment? Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. But Seattle is doing more poorly than the areas around it. And one of the difficulties in examining the economic data of when things go up and when things go down is that it's very difficult to tease out of data what is the effect strictly of that one thing that happened. You know, let's say you do something positive in a bad economic time and jobs decline. It's difficult to say with a great degree of certainty that jobs wouldn't have declined anyway and that the thing
would
you
they
did
have declined
was actually
more.
Helpful.
Yeah.
And the same is true if you do something that I think has a negative effect when jobs are going up. Did that cause the negative, the jobs going up? Or were jobs going up anyway. Well, in Seattle, we have one of those cases where in one area they did something, in the other area they didn't, and nothing else to speak of is different in those two areas. And jobs grow significantly faster in low income, in low wage areas and in low skill areas outside of Seattle than they do inside Seattle. So again, the economic Representative Silly looks at this and says, oh, the economics, they're all one way. And I look at it and I think, oh, yeah, the economics are all one way. And we each think it's our way.
Well, and I want to go to our listeners and hear what their way might be. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in Exchange, we are revisiting the minimum wage debate in this fall's elections. A minimum wage increase is on the ballot in about 5 states, and it went up in 14 states around the country at the beginning of the year. We're looking at how this is being talked about in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And both of you, let's go to our listeners. George joins us from Concord. Hi, George. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, George.
I had two comments. The first one is my understanding of what's happening in some of these areas where the minimum wage is being raised is that people at low wages are receiving government benefits. That they get the greater wages, they lose those government benefits, whether it be WIC or housing assistance, whatever, and they find themselves in no better circumstance after the minimum wage is raised. The second comment I would have is that when an employer has to dramatically increase wages at the bottom, those people who are making $4 or $5 or $6 an hour more than what those other people were making, now there's a lot of pressure to increase those wages as well. So when you look at the economic impact of raising the minimum wage for the bottom people, you also have to see where there's a lot of pressure on those middle wages to provide commensurately.
George, thank you very much for the comments. And to the first one about government benefits, now, Representative Silly, that's often used as an argument to raise the minimum wage, that if people are making more, they maybe won't have to rely on food stamps or housing assistance. But he's saying, but then when they lose those benefits, they're in bad shape.
What he's referring to is something that we call the benefits cliff. Okay, so there is, and I don't know the exact number. I think it's somewhere around $8.50 or $9 in the state of New Hampshire, where if you only raise the minimum wage to that level, people actually end up, on average, across the country, about $28 further in the hole than they were with a minimum wage and with their benefits. So that's why we have to look at getting much, much closer. And we ought to be talking about livable wages, quite frankly. But he's right in that regard. We have to be careful about how we do this in terms of not harming the very people that we're trying to help. But on that point, I would also say that what happens here is that government protects companies that offer low wages. Those folks can't survive on $7.25, $7.50, $7.75. I mean, we have about 11,000 people in the state of New Hampshire that make at or below the minimum wage. If you add in those folks that are making $7.50, $7.75, $8, you still can't live on that. And that ends up to be about 76,000 people.
What do you think about that, Charlie? The argument that, you know, it's almost welfare for low-wage companies, that they pay people very little and then people have to rely on taxpayer assistance. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that there's a you know, taxpayer assistance is designed to help people who, to some extent, are working part time, who are working at relatively low wages. We're talking about people at on people at minimum wage jobs or below minimum wage jobs, which is another category, are about 2.5% of workers nationally. Very few people stay at that wage for very long. Most people within 12 months, the vast majority of minimum wage workers within 12 months will have received a wage and moved out of that category. That's a good thing. We should.
So it's really a starting wage.
Well, for most of us, and I think most of us here and most of our listeners will have had our first job. I think it was my fourth or fifth job before I earned above the minimum wage. And one of the things that you do is you enter the workforce, you develop work skills, you learn how to work. And particularly for low-skill workers, you gradually develop a position. You're not going to start at a job that pays twice the minimum wage. You're going to start at the minimum wage and slowly progress to that. So It's an experience gaining mechanism. It's a good thing. Is there a problem with a benefits cliff? Yeah, there is. That's generally a problem in how we arrange benefits in this country in general, is that we create benefits where there's a cliff rather than a gradual ratcheting down of a benefit.
So while you're gaining those skills at that minimum wage job, if you're having a hard time feeding your family, that's not a good thing.
It's not a good thing. And it's but if you raise the minimum wage, you will have fewer people working in minimum wage jobs. You will have fewer people working fewer hours. It is a tremendous benefit. If you, let's say you double the minimum wage, for lack of a better example, it would be a great thing for the people who kept their job and got their wage doubled. But it would be a bad thing for the people who got their hours reduced significantly, and the people who lost their job, or the people who weren't hired in the first place. I mean, the truth is that if you raise the price of anything, you get less of it. And a minimum wage is the price of an entry-level job. And one of the things we see, I mean, frankly, the economic literature on this is very clear. There's a National Bureau of Economic Research study in 2007 where they did a complete literature review. It's the most comprehensive one that had been done in 30 years. And they found a significant disincentive a significant employment disincentive.
Well, so you're saying that when the minimum wage goes up, employers, just that input, so to speak, in economic terms, costs more, so they use less of it.
Yeah.
Well, that's something that came up in our debate with the gubernatorial candidates a couple weeks ago. So let's just hear a little bit of that discussion. We're going to hear Chris Sununu and Colin Van Ostern at our gubernatorial forum a couple weeks ago at St. Anselm College. Let's hear. Another question from our listener. After your first term as governor, what would the minimum wage here in New Hampshire be? Councilor Sununu.
I defer to the federal minimum wage.
So keep it the way it is?
Yeah.
So if the federal minimum wage goes up, New Hampshire's would go up?
Yes.
Okay. And if it goes away, we would have no minimum wage.
So, Councilor Van Ostern, what would the minimum wage be here if you were governor at the end of your term?
I think it'll be a negotiation between our governor and our next legislature. I've suggested that a good place to start the negotiation would be $12 an hour. Today it's $7.25. I suspect we'll end up somewhere in the middle.
That's a business killer.
Okay, again, that's Chris Sununu and Colin Van Ostern at our gubernatorial forum a couple weeks ago. So, Representative Sealey, the concern is, as Chris Sununu said, that it's a business killer.
It's
you make
not.
Wages
it's
too expensive.
Not. It's not. And Charlie, you know, was quite right when he said we'll cite different economic studies. But, I mean, it goes all the way back to 1993 with a study between New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where New Jersey was very aggressive, raised their minimum wage at the time by 25%. The study looked at just fast food restaurants, compared them across the borders, and found no negative impact on employment or restaurant growth, job growth. You know, Charlie talks about entry-level jobs, but the reality is only about 25% of those people making, you know, at or below minimum wage, only about 25% are teenagers. Beyond that, I mean, we've got 48% are somewhere between 18 and 24. So, you know, I'd say the other 25% are between, you know, 20 and 24. That leaves 52% of our workers in the state of New Hampshire that are at or below minimum wage and over the age of 24. And by the way, there a lot of those folks, those workers, are women and women with children.
What do you think the minimum wage should be in New Hampshire, Representative Sealey?
We can peg it at almost anything. But if you look at, if it had just kept up with inflation and we didn't have to have this debate constantly about raising the minimum wage, it'd be $10 and $10 plus, $10.61, I think. If it kept up with productivity, if it kept up with what workers actually put out and how they enrich their employers, it would be 21 something. Okay. So, and then if you look at something that's livable in the state of New Hampshire, I mean, our standard of living, our cost of living is 21% higher than the national average. So, for me, I think the $15 an hour rate is getting much closer to a livable wage.
Well, we will talk more in just a moment. And thank you for that call, George. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, we'll find out how other states have been approaching this issue of whether or not to raise the minimum wage. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're revisiting the minimum wage debate. Several states, including Maine, have minimum wage increases on their ballots. We're looking at how this is being talked about here in the Granite State. And let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. If you prefer Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, it's NHPR Exchange. Here's the question. New Hampshire's minimum wage right now is tied to the federal minimum at $7.25 an hour. Do you think New Hampshire should untie its wage to the federal level and raise it like other states have? Why or why not? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Charlie Arlinghaus, Representative Jackie Silly, joining us now on the phone is Elaine Povich. She's a staff writer for Stateline, a publication of Pew Charitable Trusts. She's been covering this issue. And Elaine, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
So which states have the minimum wage, Elaine, as an issue before them in November?
Okay, you've got five, including Maine, which you mentioned.
Right.
The others are Arizona, Colorado, South Dakota, and Washington State. All of them except South Dakota have increases on the ballot in an unusual method. South Dakota is actually allowing a lower minimum wage for kids under 18. It's interesting that they're going that way as opposed to increasing, but it's part of the argument about what effect raising the minimum wage would have.
Now, some of these proposals, judging from your reporting, Elaine, are creative. It isn't just, you know, on this day the minimum wage will increase to this much. There's some experimentation out there as to how states go about this. Off-ramps, for example. What are those, Elaine?
Okay. The state of California, not surprisingly, kind of led the way on this. And just to provide a little bit of background, some of the arguments about raising the minimum wage have to do with the economy. Those who think that raising the minimum is problematic bring up the idea that, okay, this is great. You know, the economy's coming out of the recession. Everything's kind of pumping along right now. We're great. We can afford this. But what happens during the next economic downturn? And, of course, there's going to be one. You know, good times don't last forever. So California decided to look at this in a global sense and say, okay, we get that when the economy is not doing very well, it's more difficult to have higher wages. Businesses can't afford it. So they took an economic snapshot into account and basically wrote a law that says the minimum wage will go up in stages over the next 5 years. But if there are two quarters of negative growth or several other measures of economic depression that they gauge, then the governor, in consultation with his economic advisors in the legislature, can basically say, okay, let's take an exit ramp here. Let's call a halt. Let's, you know, get off the highway, stop for gas, and, you know, wait until the economy gets a little bit better. So it freezes the wage wherever it is until the economy recovers enough sufficiently so that they feel that increasing the wage again would not be a further drag on the economy.
So, Charlie Arlinghaus, what do you think about this, the idea of an off-ramp in case, you know, the economy slows down or a state budget gets too tight?
Well, it doesn't interest me particularly in that I think the argument against a minimum wage can be caricatured, and I think that's one of them. It's not that the minimum that raising the minimum wage will have a deleterious effect on the economy per se, or that businesses will start to close. The economic disincentives that are talked about are economic disincentives for low income entry level employment, and those economic disincentives exist regardless of whether the economy is good or bad. What you're doing is reducing the ability of people to enter the market, and I want people to enter the market just as much in good times as I do in bad times. And if I think that it has a negative impact, and I do, on low-income, low-skilled employees starting their career, then I should be opposed to it, whether there's a good economic time or a bad economic time.
Representative Silly, how do you feel about this off-ramp idea that California has done?
Well, it's interesting. And I know that in Australia, which has some of the highest minimum wages in the world, has different levels for different age groups, you know, in out of concern, I think, for those entry-level positions. And so, you know, it's been tried there. Some states are going with a different policy for larger businesses than for smaller businesses. I mean, I would certainly look at all of those factors. But I do think that it's a bit of a scare tactic to say, you know, those low-wage jobs are going to go away. The reality is that companies that offer low-wage jobs, I mean, you hear it, for example, out of the restaurant sector. Oh, if you raise the wage, they're going to go to automation. Guess what? They've been going to automation now for the last few years, and that's accelerating. That's why when you go in and sit at a, you know, a chain restaurant, you've got a little, you know, iPad there to plug in your, you know, your order or to pay your bill. That's already happening.
Would it happen faster if labor became more expensive?
I don't believe so. I think that companies that believe that, you know, the race to the bottom with paying workers are going to do it regardless of what the wage is. I mean, when you think of the restaurant industry, it's deplorable wages that are offered. I mean, it's, you know, something that came out of slavery, as a matter of fact. So they're doing that in any case.
Well, Elaine, I want to ask you about a couple other just different ways that other states are approaching this. For example, Elaine, what have you heard about states applying different minimum wages for different groups of people, like teenagers versus adults or large companies versus small companies? What's happening on that end, Elaine?
Yeah, there's a lot of what I call half measures going on here. And again, it's the argument that it's too expensive to do it all at once, or it will hurt companies to do it all at once. Without taking sides, and I certainly don't, many states have decided that in order to entice more younger workers into the market, to get companies to hire younger workers, particularly for summer jobs or, you know, fast food jobs or summer camp jobs, more summer camp than fast food, they create what's called a sub-minimum wage. And they argue that this will get younger folks into the labor force, that the companies will be able to afford, you know, more of them, where they sort of get their feet wet, understand what it's like to come to work every day, learn about how to survive in a job market, and yet not make enough money and possibly think about, well, maybe I should be doing something better with my life than, you know, teaching kids how to swim at a summer camp. I don't know whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. I know I made a sub-minimum wage once a long time ago, working at a refreshment stand at the beach, and I didn't much care for the job. I was happy to have it, but it was very, very low paying, and it was not a lot of fun. But anyway, I think it's a double-edged sword. I think people try to justify it by saying it will entice more younger folks to get jobs, but I don't know if it works or it doesn't, but there's an awful lot of it out there.
Well, and I wonder what you folks in the studio think. And first to you, Representative Cilley, some states have said, you know, large businesses need to do this, small businesses, you're off the hook, or, you know, not for teenagers, but yes, for everybody else, we should raise. I mean, what do you think about these differentiations among groups of companies or groups of people?
Well, it's not, they don't let small businesses off the hook. They give them a longer window to implement it. As I said, it's something that that I'd take a serious look at if, you know, if I thought those policies were the right policies in place to, you know, to help move this along. That there isn't enough data right now suggest whether, you know, one. I mean, what I will say is it's interesting, and this came out of a conversation with my very conservative son. I have a very progressive and a very conservative son that get into these debates. And, you know, my very conservative son says, well, you know, if you did this with teenagers, I would feel, or, you know, or retirees, somehow he thinks we can break out retirees, you know, I'd feel better about it and I could support it. You know, that's an ongoing in-house debate.
Yeah, and I heard one economist say, you know, once you start carving out exceptions for one group,
exactly,
then, you know, business come back and say, well, let's carve it out for this group or that group. But I've also heard people say what you say, Representative Cilley. And I wonder what you think, Charlie. Okay, so, you know, working adults, you know, supporting themselves on their own, maybe having a family. But if the minimum wage had a carve out for teenagers and senior citizens, would you feel better about it?
If you create carve-outs for – I'm generally opposed to creating carve-outs for anybody, not for the reason that everybody will want some, but then you reach the point where the government is treating people differently. And if I say that everybody under the age of 24 can make less money than if I'm 25, I think to myself, well, I, you know, and I can't find a job because it's cheaper to hire a 24-year-old. How is that fair to me? If I carve out young people, aren't senior citizens upset about that? And do you create incentives to hire one group over another because of the lower price of hiring that one group or not? I come back to the point, you know, we do see and we have seen in the restaurant industry, and, you know, there are studies of the New Jersey minimum wage hikes that Representative Silley talks about, which show that when you look at low income categories across the state, there was a significant disincentive and there was slower growth. Particularly when you compared similar counties across state lines.
Well,
and I think that – and again, you run into that situation. And will you mitigate the effect by carving out some group or another? Yes. But what happens then is that the government is then saying, yeah, this is really bad. So we're only going to inflict the pain on a certain group of people.
So or you only hire teenagers and retirees.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead, Representative Silley.
I just want to, you know, sort of push back on that a little bit. Charlie, we said at the beginning that, you know, you might cite your own studies and I'd cite my own studies. We're citing the same study here. And I don't think that was the conclusion.
We're citing studies of the same instance. But I think we're not citing the actually same study.
We're citing two different cross-state studies of the restaurant industries.
There are a number of people. The New Jersey minimum wage hike was one that received a great deal of study, and I think there were probably 10 or 15 different studies of that, not just one. But I suspect, and I'll look up my citation and I'll send it to you off the air, but I suspect that we're citing different studies of that.
Well, let me bring Elaine back into this for one more
Hi.
Question. And Elaine,
I just wanted to say one thing. The argument that your guests are engaged in shows exactly why many states have had to do something of a compromise. In other words, in order to get folks on both sides of this issue to agree, they have had to make compromises, whether those compromises are off-ramps or whether those compromises are tiered wages or whether those compromises are stretching out the length of, you know, the staggered implementation for maybe a hire at the very end, but they drag it out 6-8 years. These are the kinds of compromises that states have had to make to get these questions and these minimum wage questions passed in various places. And it's interesting because you see where the arguments come down and you see the compromises that have been made. In California, they accepted the off-ramps largely because there was going to be a ballot issue on this, on raising the minimum wage. And the history shows that if you put this on the ballot, it's very likely to pass because more people vote who are closer to making the minimum than, you know, are closer to not making the minimum. So it's just a matter of scale. More people earn less. So you find that these ballot measures generally pass. In order to – the businesses were opposed to putting the ballot measure on because they knew they were going to lose. So in order to avoid putting it on the ballot, they said, all right, look, we'll agree to raise the wage, but let's make a deal and make it more slow, make it subject to off-ramps. It's really interesting the kinds of machinations that states have gone through in order to get some raise in the minimum wage at all.
One last question for you, Elaine. How have you seen it work when a city like Los Angeles or D.C. or San Francisco has a higher minimum wage than the surrounding towns? You know, it's one thing for a whole state to raise the minimum, but to have a city do it, but the suburbs and the small towns around it not do it, creates an interesting labor market dynamic.
It does. And a lot of it has to do with the economic situation of the folks who are making the wage. If the city and the surrounding areas has a nice public transportation system, they can bring folks in from the suburbs to make the higher wage, you will attract more workers. If not, they're stuck. They stay where they are. It shows that the dynamic of wages is inextricably linked to the dynamic of transportation, dynamic of economic well-being in various places around. It's really an interesting study. I've only scratched the surface, but I know that it does make a difference to folks.
All right. Elaine, great to talk to you. Thank you very much for helping us out.
All right. Happy to be here today. Enjoy yourself and don't get inundated by too many political ads.
Too late for that, but I appreciate the sentiment. That's
okay,
Elaine Povich, staff writer for Stateline, a publication of the Pew Charitable Trusts. Again, today in the Exchange, we're looking at this minimum wage debate around the country and especially here in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at NHPR Exchange. And let's go back to the phones. And Anne's waiting in Amherst. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
I have a couple things. How do you decide what a livable wage is? And in addition to that, how do you address the situation that I'm in? And this goes to home care. I have my husband at home who is incredibly handicapped. He's paralyzed from the neck down.
Wow. I'm so sorry, Anne.
But we've made the choice for him to be at home, and we've set up our home to accommodate all of his needs. And what that means is that I employ, because I still have to work full-time, we receive no government benefits, I employ two people year-round to assist him so that I can work, continue to work full time. I end up paying about $38,000 a year in payroll and taxes and all of those things for those employees.
So you're worried if the minimum wage goes up, you may be shelling out even more for that.
Well, it's not even a question of shelling out even more. It's that this whole, I'm part of a whole new industry that people that are going to choose to remain at home and are going to need caregivers at home. So, you know, when you turn around and you talk about increasing the livable wage, I already pay well above the minimum wage here in the state of New Hampshire. And unfortunately, there are employees that are going to look at it and say, if the minimum wage increases by $3, my rate should increase by $3. And I won't be able to have care for my husband.
Oh, Anne. Okay, well, let's address that. And this gets to the point that we talked about earlier. When the minimum goes up, is there pressure for all wages to go up? It's also a point raised by Rob in an email. He says, ask your guests to explain how raising the minimum wage does not eventually increase cause an increase in all wages across the board, then an increase in the cost of doing business, and finally a raise in the cost of goods and services to the consumer to remain profitable. Rob says, does anyone really win in the end? So maybe to you first, Representative Silly, you know, we talked about this earlier, but the concern being, and boy, very real in Anne's case, that wages will become too expensive for employers.
And some of these questions are very complex, but I will say that a livable, first of all, to her first question, and Anne, I'm sorry to hear that of the difficulties that, you know, that you and your husband have had. But a livable wage is assessed according to what it costs for the basic standard of living. And as I said, in the state of New Hampshire, that's 21% higher than the national average for housing and transportation and so on. So just the basic standard of living. And we have metrics for that. In New Hampshire, it's, you know, it could be anywhere from $15 to $21, depending on whether you have children and so on. But in regard to and I lost my train of thought, forgive me, but so there's the issue of how do you get to the standard of living. Then there's the issue of the pressure on pricing. Okay,
right.
So
does it raise the
all
cost
of the
everything?
Most of the studies, most of the credible studies show that for every 10% increase in the wage, we have less than 1% increase in pricing.
Well, Anne, I really appreciate the call, and good luck to you and your husband. Rob, thank you for the email as well. We'll take a lot more of your questions and comments in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're revisiting the minimum wage debate. Several states, including Maine, have minimum wage increases on their ballots in November. We're looking at how this is being talked about in New Hampshire, among economists, among politicians, and especially among candidates during this election year. You can join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns, personal experiences, as we heard from our caller, Anne. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Charlie Arlinghouse, Representative Jackie Sealy, let's go right back to our listeners. And Sarah joins us from Manchester. Hi, Sarah. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I think Mr. Arlinghouse is really way off base when he says that increasing the minimum wage will affect low-income people. I work with many, many, many low-income families who are working two and three jobs because their wages are right at minimum wage or very close to it. Working two and three jobs to support a family is not sustainable, and it's not good for family life. The people that I talk to, all of whom are low-wage workers, really, really support increasing the minimum wage. And $15 is just a starting point.
$15, so that would be a doubling of the current wage.
Well, it'd have to be on a graduated basis and go up slowly, but I am hoping that our new New Hampshire legislature will take action on this as soon as the new session begins.
Okay, Sarah, thank you for the call. And Charlie, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I was going to agree with her, except that she said I'm way off base. But that's not the part I agree with. But I'm not sure she completely understands what I'm saying, which is that, I mean, I agree with her that it is a difficult thing. I want more people moving into the workforce. I want more people having jobs. And it strikes me that if you double the minimum wage, as she says, and the higher the increase, the greater this effect, the lower the increase, the less this effect, but there is this effect. It will be beneficial for the people whose wages go up. It will not be beneficial for the people whose hours are reduced, who don't get hired, and who lose their job. And that will happen. I talk about how, you know, we'll each cite different studies. We'll try to cherry pick studies. But the most comprehensive literature review David Newmark did for the National Bureau of Economic Research in 2007, he turned it, and I apologize, I don't remember his co-author, but they turned it into a book by the MIT Press. They literally wrote the textbook on this. And there is a significant employment disincentive. And what that means is that when you raise the price of employment, people will have their hours reduced. Some people will not have their hours reduced. They will receive more money. It will be very good for them, and there's no question about that. But it will be very bad for other people. Some of them will be some of the people that she works with, and I don't want that. The majority of people move out of the minimum wage within 12 months. The majority of people receiving the minimum wage work part-time. The majority of the people receiving the minimum wage work in households that make significantly more than the poverty level or the minimum wage. The average income of a minimum wage worker, the average family income, not that worker's income, is $53,000. Now, some people are struggling to work on just the minimum wage and take care of the family. It strikes me that the way to help them is to address it through other means and not raising the price of work for everyone else.
If some of the people that Sarah works with have three jobs because minimum wage is so low, let's say the minimum wage goes up, Charlie, and then that person can afford to only work one job, which is better for their family. Then there's two other jobs that, you know, someone else could pick up.
No, that would be good. But again, and I think that if you look at the Newmark Literature Review, which examines all the economic studies on this, what you'll find is that on net, what happens, and we look at this on net instead of, you know, one individual case where one person and then two other people have jobs. But as a whole, in the aggregate, fewer people will be working and more people will be working fewer hours as well.
Go ahead, Representative Sealy.
I don't know how you explain then that the minimum wage, when we actually believe that there should be a floor in wages, and I would go further and say that I think that there was a more common thread throughout society that we should have shared prosperity. The minimum wage actually peaked in the 1960s. That also coincided with the broadest expansion of the middle class in the United States, because it does put pressure to raise all wages. So if it were that negative an impact, we should have seen it at that time. And instead, there's been an erosion of what that wage is worth. We've lost, you know, the last wage hike to $7.25 was in 2009. It's already lost 8% of its purchasing power.
Should the minimum wage be tied to inflation, Charlie? What do you think?
I wouldn't tie it to inflation because again, what we're talking about is when a change happens, and it's the truth of tax changes, regulatory changes, any kind of rule change in government. What happens is there's a period of time before the change and a period of time after the change. And employers will make their changes at the time that change occurs. They will change their behavior when that change occurs, and it which frankly explains why the rise and the fall, the up and the down. Employers respond psychologically, like all of us do, to the immediate effect.
Well, I've got a stack of emails here and a lot of callers. Let's go to Keene, where John is on the line. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm interested in what happens if we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and that, of course, will be inflationary. And what happens to our elder citizens that have other income besides Social Security that are already fixed in for what they have consider what their needs are going to be, and those needs are going to increase because of inflation.
So the price impact, Representative Silly, and if McDonald's has to pay, you know, teenagers more money to flip burgers, will they increase the price of the burgers?
So this becomes a complex topic that we need more time for, but here's what the empirical evidence says. So for every 10% of increase in the wage, there is less than a 1%. It goes somewhere between 0.4 and 0.7% increase in pricing.
So prices will go up, but a little bit, you're saying?
Very little bit in relation to the, you know, to the overall increase in the minimum wage.
How is that possible? Because it is a higher
cost.
That's
the conversation that will take a longer time. It's complex, and it has to do with, you know, just a quick example is that so much of the profits of a company are now going to that top 1% that we hear a lot about. That money can be, you know, used to increase minimum wages, and the fact that there is a competitive environment for most businesses. So it does not have, and one of the latest, you know, sort of gold standard studies shows that it does not increase inflation. What was the other question that he had? The
effect on senior citizens who live on fixed
and so incomes. So some of the most recent studies actually show that seniors that the economic life of seniors actually increase in part because so many of those folks are in the workforce.
I think I agree that there's a very modest effect on inflation, and I think the reason is the dynamic I talked about before, that a business in looking at its total costs will adjust its total costs because it cannot afford to just ratchet up prices, to just ratchet up other things that put pressure on inflation. They will make adjustments. It's why the economic literature shows that people's hours are reduced and that some people lose their jobs is because the employer will even out when you have a cost of doing business. You will adjust your cost of doing business. If some of your inputs, in this case the labor input, is significantly more expensive, you will adjust that input to make up for it.
Do you think there should be a minimum wage at all, Charlie?
I think that, yeah. I mean, I think that we are in a situation where again, you start in a situation we can all talk about, you know, the theory of everything. And if we were starting in a brave new world from scratch, would we say nobody can ever hire anybody for less than $20 or $25 an hour? Maybe, or would there be no minimum wage and it would be a negotiated economic position? You know, maybe. But what really happens is you start where you are today, and we are, you know, this is 2016, and we are, you know, we're living with the last 100 years of moving this up and moving this down and moving this around, and we have this this factor in some other area of the economy and some other regulation. So we're starting where we are, and I think that's what you have to do.
Go ahead, Representative Silly.
And I just want to jump in here that we're starting in a place we have moved to a place where it seems like there's been an erosion of the appreciation of what workers contribute to the society. And I will go back to, if they were making what they were actually producing for not only society but for their owners, the wage would be $21 an hour. So, you know, we used to have a better appreciation. And this is just a piece of how we look at those people who labor and create the goods and services for society. Our companies used to be much more generous in benefits, health care, retirement benefits, and they've pulled back on that. And somehow there's this pervasive thought that workers are nothing more than a cog in a wheel. And I think that the minimum wage is only one aspect of this, and we should be talking truly about a full range of how we view workers' value to our society.
The workers are only one aspect of this. Minimum wage is only one aspect of this. But I would argue people do not devalue work. They do value work. And some of the retreat from things like the benefits. We did live in a fairly paternalistic society a notion of it where you might have the same job for 30 years and there were pensions and there were health care. And the cost of them was relatively de minimis by comparison to what they are today. And it is as the cost of those that has gone up that it becomes a significant input into the business cost. In addition to that, I think the significant move in a global sense toward things like profit sharing suggests that there is a value for both high and low wage workers.
Real quick, Rick. I
want to just say that this has shifted. So and again, I'll say they're devalued. You take one company, the Walmart company. And I know that's the standard that a lot of us use, but it's illustrative. You know, in 6 years, 8 Waltons took home $300 million that wasn't even taxed. It was in compensation. But because it was called, development, monies, it fell under a non-tax category, which it would never happen to a low-wage worker. Low-wage workers made that family the wealthiest family on the planet. And somehow that didn't trickle down to showing the appreciation for those workers.
Let's take some more calls. And Viola is in Manchester. Hi, Viola. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hello. Good morning. Morning, Laura. My
morning.
Name is Viola, and I have a comment.
Sure. Go ahead, Viola.
Yeah. My organization, which is the Grand State Organizing Project, has been knocking on doors and talking to voters. And what we find is that most people actually support raising the minimum wage. We've spoken to over 1,000 voters, and they all agree that the wage should be raised.
And how much do they think it should be raised by, Viola?
My idea is $15 an hour over a period of time. I know it's not a living wage, but it would lift so many families out of poverty.
Okay. Viola, thank you for calling in. So let's turn it to New Hampshire, as Viola says she's been going around and knocking on doors. And to you first, I think, Charlie, how do you hear this being talked about in the Granite State this year?
Well, I think it's one of the centerpieces of one of the candidates running for governor's campaign, Colin Van Ostern. Central planks of his platform. So anytime one of the two major candidates, particularly in a closely contested race, talk about an issue, that becomes a major issue in the campaign. I think it is a major issue in the campaign. I think minimum wage has always been one of those issues where if you ask people, for example, in polling or Viola's knocking on doors, if you ask people sort of off the top of their head, should wages go up? Yeah, wages should go up. I think, though, that like so many issues in politics, perhaps like every issue in politics, it is an issue that people think very passionately about only in relatively small numbers. And so I think it will likely, regardless of who wins the election, be more of a negotiation and a discussion.
Well, I think all the Democrats, right, Representative Cilley, are talking about $12 an hour. Maggie Hassan's talking about that. Colin Van Ostern, Hillary Clinton.
Well, it's especially in New Hampshire. I mean, I can't speak for all the candidates, but especially in New Hampshire, under the extreme Bill O'Brien years, we actually eliminated our minimum wage. I mean, the statement of that, I think, is telling. And so what I hear on, for Charlie's side of the aisle is, no, we don't want a minimum wage. I mean, I was glad to say you at least wanted one, but I think that's what it's become. We don't want one versus what should it be. The other thing that I would say is it isn't just, well, it's a nice thing that people talk about. And if you ask them, yeah. I mean, we see in referendum states, as Elaine Povich said, when the measure of raising the minimum wage is on the ballot and citizens have an opportunity to voice their opinion, they are voting in that. So I can't think of a place where it's been on the ballot that it's gone down.
Well, and talking about politics again, seems like the Democrats here in the state have taken their cues from Hillary Clinton, who has said $12 an hour. Let's hear what the Republican nominee Donald Trump has said about the minimum wage. Here he is in a late July rally, and credit to CNN for this.
The minimum wage has to go up. People are at least $10, but it has to go up. But I think that states, federal, I think that states should really call the shot. As an example, I live in New York. It's very expensive in New York. You can't buy a hot dog for the money you're talking about. You go to other states, and it's not expensive at all. Now, what it does is puts New York at a disadvantage if the minimum wage is right, companies move out and things, you know, bad things happen. At the same time, people have to be taken care of.
So there you go, Charlie, kind of summarizing some of the difficult issues that we've been talking about. You know, he says minimum wage should go up to $10 an hour, but also let the states call the shots.
Yeah, the fact that Donald Trump doesn't always agree with everything I say is probably not a surprise to most of my friends. And the fact that I had not heard him say that is also shows you how much attention I'm paying to the whole stupid presidential election.
States that have a higher minimum wage, are they at a disadvantage? I mean, for example, New Hampshire has a lower one than Massachusetts, and the Massachusetts economy is doing really well.
Well, I you know, people talk about this and the notion of cross-border this and cross-border that. I'm a big believer in economic competition between states. Most of the jobs where people are paid at minimum wage or below minimum wage are not as susceptible to cross-border sales. The retail industry, for example, where you might have cashiers and whatnot making minimum wage, those location decisions are probably based less on labor costs because the difference is not dramatic and it's not a significant part of their input than it is based on other factors in your state, in New Hampshire's case, the lack of a sales tax. So I think that the cross-state border competition is less susceptible to wage growth, particularly among the 2.5% of the people that make minimum wage.
Well, there is so much more we could have talked about. A lot of emails and phone calls that we didn't even get to. And there's an active conversation going on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So if you didn't get on the air, I apologize. Go there and join the conversation. And I want to thank the two of you very much for being here on a Monday morning. Charlie Arlinghaus, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlie Arlinghaus, president of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. Representative Cilley, good to see you too. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's Representative Jackie Cilley, Democratic State Representative from Barrington. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our intern is Liz Torrey. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.